Session number 22346, Reel 12.
Captain Riggs, Reel 12. When you were transformed into a mule supported unit, did you have to get rid of a lot of equipment to make it sort of light enough?
Well, yes, indeed, because all the sort of mess equipment and stuff was got rid of. We were hardly on a peacetime footing, needless to say, even before that, because as you would have found, we were on the move quite a lot. But we had some tentage and stuff like that. We got rid of all of that. And as I say, we split the battalion into two columns. The CO commanded one, and the second in command commanded the other. Except there was quite a lot of change at the top, because nobody could go into Burma who was over 40. So we lost our CO and one or two others, and also some other guys who seemed perfectly fit. But if they had flat feet or anything like that, they were not allowed to come in. And they formed a sort of rear headquarters for which we had a use later on, which I shall tell you about.
How old was the CO?
He would have been 50-ish, I should have thought. He just in the black and tan set up at the end of the First World War.
Yeah.
So he really was, by ordinary standards, let alone these, he was old.
An elderly CO.
That's right. Yes,
by that stage of the war, most of those had been combed out.
Yes, he was wounded in. He was our second in command in Tobruk. Yes. He was wounded there, but he came back to us and was commanding the battalion at the time this happened. But he off he went somewhere. I can't remember where. I think he came back home somewhere, and we had another CO came in who had been on Eisenhower's staff in the north for the torch for the North African landings, Pat Eason, who came from the Royal Scots, the Dandy Ninth, and he took over the battalion, and the guy who was our second in command, who was a good deal younger, John Barrow, who was only 26 at the time, I think, commanded the other column. Now, the column makeup was about 230 men and, I don't know, 25 mules, roughly, up and down the column. That was the composition. You had a battalion, you had a column headquarters, and I think one sort of adjutant type staff officer, intelligence officer. Somebody who did some is odd jobbing for him, if you like. And there was a radio, which meant three or four guys, because we all took fairly high in those days fairly high grade ciphers in with us. Mm-hmm. Everything had to be encoded, and an RAF section. We had a pilot. An RAF pilot and a couple of RAF guys with him as well. They were signalers too. They had a radio set up.
What was the point of having a pilot?
For supply drops and air assaults, which some of us managed to set up from time to time. We had our by the time we went into Burma, we had our own private air force. Commanded by a colonel, an American colonel, Philip Cochran, and it was mainly Dakota, Douglas DC-3 Dakotas, which flew us in, and after we'd done our training in the following March, it flew us in. But there are also dive bombers, the Vulti Vengeance, which was flown partly by the Indian Air Force and the RAF, and they were used. I didn't experience their use, but for some particularly where they had these blocks they put on the railway later on, they were quite useful there in bombing the Japanese who were trying to dislodge them. But that's a bit later on. So there was an RAF section, and of course they would also advise about supply drops and talk to the pilots.
So
and there were light aircraft as well. They had the little Fairchild and Stinson light aircraft flown by Americans who would come down in 50 yards if need be and pick up wounded and drop guys off and that sort of thing. Absolutely wonderful. They'd fly anywhere, and they were truly wonderful and very comforting to have.
How many passengers could you get into one of those?
The little ones?
With one aircraft, one passenger.
You could take the pilot seat out and slide a stretcher into the little fuselage, but it was sort of no longer than, I don't know, 15, 20 feet. Mm. Not that long. Little single-engined aircraft.
You mentioned doing training before going in.
Yes.
What did the training, what were the priorities within the training?
We started off, as I say, we were split into these columns. We had four rifle platoons. There was a support platoon which had 3-inch mortars and life buoy flamethrowers, which were meant to burn holes in Japanese dugouts and what have you. They were mule borne. They were in this so-called support platoon. And then there was a so-called commando platoon, which was made up of sappers and people like that, who would have explosives and all sorts of things like that. So if we wanted to blow up railway lines and bridges and things like that, we had the capacity to do that. They wouldn't carry tons of explosive, but you'd have a special supply drop but sometime before you were going to do a particular job like that.
They sound wrong.
So we had sappers, we had RAF, otherwise there were guys from the battalion.
Your commander, it sounds rather more like an assault pioneer.
Well, no, I think it was just the name they put on it. The assaulting setup was what they called the battle group, which was the four rifle platoons. But of course, you could produce a mix.
Yes.
Depending on what sort of tactical thing you wanted to.
How many men would there be in a rifle platoon then? Would that be the.
Smallish, I think, with 230 in the column altogether, I think. They would have three sections probably, about up to 30. Nominally, it never worked out that way because, as you'll hear later on, the two columns were put together and there was only 120 men left. But that was a little later on. And so we started off with our training in the middle of India somewhere. It didn't really matter where we were. Everything was so far away. And we started off mainly by the way, the other thing we had with us, of course, which were absolutely vital, we had a reconnaissance platoon.
Yeah.
Which was about 20 men from the battalion and 8 Buriffs. Burma riflemen, who were Karen tribesmen, who were locally raised, and the Burma Rifles had done wonderful things in the first expedition, and they did wonderful things in the second one. Mm. So every reconnaissance platoon of each column had this little section of Burma Rifle with a jemadar, i.e. Jemadar was a locally appointed NCO, as you know, a sort of sergeant major type, and about eight riflemen.
Were they with you during the training as well?
Well, yes, and some of them, of course, were experienced. But their main job once we got in there, of course, was to take their uniforms off and walk into a village, find out what was going on, and come back and tell the reconnaissance platoon commander and see what it was all about. I'll tell you a bit more about that because I commanded a reconnaissance platoon in one of the columns. So that was particularly my baby. These are wonderful little guys, these Karen tribesmen from the eastern border of Burma, who were having such a terrible time being knocked around by this disgusting regime today. Most of them are in refugee camps over on the Thai border. And so we set off training. Well, we all did our own separate bits of training. Most of the training was in very small penny packets, because that's how people we were going to have to operate. But the first thing they did, they took the whole column out, and we sat them down in the forest, and we said, right, we're here for 24 hours, and we're going to keep absolutely dead quiet. This is right at the beginning of our training, and this was really, really funny. The orders were, if you had anything to say to somebody, you walked across and you said it very quietly. You didn't whisper, because whispers carried much further. And you didn't move unless you had to. And you couldn't light a fire or anything like that unless you were given permission by the column commander to do so. And we had the first exercises in going into a column lager, which we did every night when we were in there. And we had absolutely fixed drill for this, because the column commander would get up to the front of the column as it was getting dark, and we were going to try to settle in for the night, assuming we, as we could most times. And he said, this is my tree. And that's all he had to say. And the leading platoon went north for X number of paces, and then went left and right. This is of the four rifle platoons. One went north, one went east. The other one turned around and went southwards. And you had a tighter square as you could get. And then within the square was the commando platoon and the mules and this, that, and the other. And in the middle was the RAF section and the battalion and the column commander with his radio sets. And indeed, of course, immediately you set up your radios.
How long would it take you to actually get that
into lager? No time at all, really. After we've done it a few times, you do it with your eyes shut. Mm. But very nearly. Indeed, we normally had to do it in semi-darkness. Mm. And apparently, they managed to do it without even thinking. Like the armoured columns used to do in the Western Desert. Exactly the same thing would happen. They had a pattern. You know, their column commander or whatever he was say, right, I'm here for the night, and the tanks would go out, the armored cars screening beyond there. The sentry setup was preordained. You know, the platoon would, each platoon would have to sort of set up some kind of watch, whatever it was. I never experienced this very much, because as I said, I commanded a reconnaissance platoon, and I was days away from them, which perhaps I'll tell you a bit later on. But this is how the training started. And then we had to learn how to get across rivers. And we hit a huge problem. We found that over half the battalion couldn't swim. Today, you know, kids come out of primary school at 3 o'clock, they're into the leisure centre and they're swimming before they know what they're doing. But this wasn't the way it was in the 1930s. Very far from it. And we had to get them, not being able to swim, but to have some confidence, you know, to get a hold of a lump of bamboo and get themselves and their kit across the river, and or their mule. And we had to spend some time doing this, just getting them into the water, and the only thing we could find was a fairly sizable sort of river nearby. But of course they got crocodiles in the rivers in India. The Mugga was a nice big fat crocodile who used to specialise, you know, eating the dead bodies which had been flown in at Benares and places like that. But no doubt there were a few up our bit of the river as well. It's one of the tributaries of the Ganges. I can't remember his name. And so we had to have guys up sitting up trees with rifles in case anybody saw a crocodile appear. We had no casualties from that. Indeed, we did our best to let the troops not know about it. We just said we have to have sentries out, you know, in case...
Anti-crocodile sentries.
Well, we didn't tell the troops that that's what they were. But in the meantime, we tried to get them confident in water, let's put it that way.
With floats. Did they make the floats themselves? Did they make their own flotation?
Well, again, you see, these little Burmese guys were wonderful, because they taught us with a ground sheet and some bamboo how to make a little thing like a little coracle. At least you could put your kit in it and then push it across and keep it, well, hopefully keep it fairly dry. if it wasn't belting, was rain anyhow. But the river crossings were something we had to address and be confident about before we got into Burma, because we knew we were going to be in there during the monsoon. After a few weeks in there, the monsoon had reached Burma. And then the rivers, which you could walk across in 2 hours' time, could be a 4 foot deep spate and really moving. Well, spates do move, of course. And so they had to be confident to do this. And indeed, we might have had to be told to get across the Irrawaddy, which was very, very, very big indeed. Normally, one would be able to commandeer boats or even have boats dropped to us, as some of them did later on. Our columns, in fact, never crossed the Irrawaddy. It so happened we went northwards instead of eastwards. But it was very much part of the training. So a certain amount of boat drill. The sappers had to be trained to deal with outboard motors, because there were occasions when they had outboard motors. There were 17 battalions of Chindits in Burma over that period of about 6 or 8 months. So they had all sorts of things dropped to them. But, you know, we had to have guys in there who could take these loads when they were dropped and to put them into use. And so there's a lot of specialist training of that kind. But the other thing we wanted to do was to treat the section commander, the corporal, to have confidence on his own in the jungle. Because either he was going to be sent off to do something, or he was going to get lost and feel confident to find his way back and to locate, you know, where we were and all the rest of it, if there was a dispersal took place. And we learned all sorts of specialized drills, because our normal method of movement was in single file. 230 men, if we're up to full complement, and 25 mules or whatever it was. And one of the drills we had to learn was if we bumped real trouble, the leading platoon, the column commander, who had a bugler, would blow a signal on it, which would tell the whole column to burst sideways, disperse, get a hell out of it, so that most of them could get away and not get chewed up in something that we weren't geared up to do. And so every man was taught there was a rendezvous 1 or 2 days ahead that they could make for in small groups, even individually, and it did happen. And the officers were given a rendezvous a week ahead. This is when the columns were on the move, which was most of the time.
Did this mean that every man had to have a map, every individual man?
No. They weren't told that, but they were told to go northwards as best they could. And very seldom was a guy absolutely isolated on his own. There were little groups of them, you know. And so it was terribly important for the junior NCOs to have great confidence, who'd say, "Say, right, chaps, you know."
How did you manage to build that confidence up?
We went out on patrols, on patrols, on patrols, and, you know, for two or three days. You'd tell a guy to go out on a patrol, and they'd stick them on trucks and take them miles away and say, "Well, okay, fellas, now the battalion is 25 miles to the southeast of here," or whatever.
Yeah.
And there you'll find them on a sort of river junction, or give them a kind of a rendezvous and say, "Right, you've got 3 days' rations on your back. And, you know, you won't die of starvation or anything like that, but out you go and find your way home." We did a little later on. We used to go out into platoons in the earlier stages, of course. And then we'd break them up into small units. And they became completely confident after a while, and so did the guys with them, of course. And no need for any other special training, and off they went. And but that was absolutely vital, of course. And we had other kinds of drills we had when we were that we may have had to have adopted when we were actually in Burma as on single file. we would have another one where they were told to, particularly before we thought we were being followed up at all, and we wanted to go into Lager for the night. You could actually turn the whole, you could say, track drill left, and the whole column would turn leftwards, and then would very carefully pick its way a couple of hundred yards through the forest, hopefully not leaving, because once a single file went through the forest, you left a beaten path that nobody could miss. You didn't need Red Indians or somebody like that to be able to do the tracking for you. And so all these little sort of things we had, which I don't know whether they ever used them very often, but it was the sort of things that could have been useful.
But you were doing this training for some months, weren't you? If you started in September,
we
till the spring of the
following
year.
We were marching with my reconnaissance platoon, of course. Mm. I had a guy who was a Burma Rifles officer attached to our brigade headquarters, and he used to spend time with the 8 reconnaissance platoons because we were 4 battalion brigades. They joined the 7th Leicesters into us, which made up the brigade group. Our brigade commander was Tom Brodie, who eventually commanded the Commonwealth Division in Korea. Tom Brodie, Manchester's, I think he was. But they were always rather remote from us, needless to say, because the columns were all over the place. And off we went. George Kahn was this Burma Rifles officer. He was a major by then with 2 MCs and had done wonderful things in the first. He was a forestry officer with Steel Brothers in Burma in the 1930s. I think it was his brother who commanded the Gloucesters and got a VC in Korea.
At the Imjin River.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But that's rather by the by. But George Kahn was quite marvellous, and he used to take us out with his little Burma rifleman, and we would he'd teach us a thing or two more than, again, getting around the jungles. Of my 3 rifle sections, they'd have one or two of these Burmese guys with them, you know, and they'd wander off, and we'd have to get them to understand much more what we were supposed to do. Our main job as the reconnaissance platoon was, well, obviously reconnaissance. Sometimes we were a week ahead of the column. We looked for somewhere to take supply drops. We looked for river crossings. Once the monsoon started, that was a problem. Or even beforehand, because getting a column across a river, even quite a small river, was a problem because of ambush.
Yeah.
If there was only one or two places where there was water and a decent sort of river crossing, and the river banks weren't sort of sheer drop of 12 feet high, which with mules, of course, was impossible, then, you know, you had to worry about whether you were going to get ambushed when you were halfway across it. And things like that, going, finding out this, finding out that, obviously locating Japanese units which were around the place hunting us all the time by this time. And before the monsoon, water was important because mules lost condition very quickly after about 24 hours. Men could go a bit longer. But mules and ponies we had originally, also a few ponies, they too just had to have water at least once a day and preferably twice. And the reconnaissance platoon was busy with all that kind of thing and getting some idea of the terrain. And we had a big radio set, the reconnaissance platoon. Often it worked back to our rear headquarters in Assam and then to the battalion or to the column commander or whoever.
How far would you be able to march in a day once you were conditioned to it?
Well, it depended on the conditions. We could move faster as a reconnaissance platoon because we were much smaller. As I say, we were 20, perhaps 30 at full strength, and very often we were not at full strength anyway, with one reason or other, guys getting sick and what have you. And so we could up and move. Also, there wasn't the palaver of getting into getting ourselves bedded down for the night, if we were able to do so. You know, we were much more smaller and more compact, and the guys got the drill very, very quickly. And but we would normally, the normal drill was that to move, to be loaded up, ready to move before first light. And then the idea is probably we would march for an hour or more and then stop, hopefully find water on the way. Well, it was still cool, and water one's mules and oneself, fill up with anything that would carry water. There were no such thing as plastic, as I mentioned to you, which was a great disadvantage. We had these just these army water
ten bottles,
and we had a thing called a chargal, which was a canvas bottle that was famous in the Indian Army, and indeed in the desert, which used to seep water very, very gently. But because of that, it was cool, very nice cool water. It didn't matter how filthy dirty it got on the outside, it was sweating the whole time. So you if you could, you would try to carry one of these as well. But one had 70 pounds on one's back. And no lovely Bergen rucksacks like no doubt the SAS and the, and the Royal Marine Commandos had and still have, I guess. And they were very uncomfortable, the packs we wore, which were the old big field service pack with extra pouches stitched onto the side. But they sat badly on you and they pulled you backwards. And
How far could a column go in a day then
It varied tremendously on the terrain, of course. First of all, Burma, you see, was like a piece of corrugated iron.
Mm.
If you're going east and west, you were uphill and down dale the whole time, and some of it was very steep, and particularly if it was raining. Funny enough, there was very little stone in Burma, and so the mud was absolutely unbelievable all the time. You were slithering about. And if it got very steep, then you had to offload a mule, hump his load up to the top, and then reload him again, get him up there. Although they normally, we reckon they could go laden anywhere where a man could go, up, not on his hands and knees. You know, so a 45 degree slope where the going was not too bad, they'd manage to
do
right.
That.
Yeah, they're wonderful. But on the other hand, if you got on the top of a long ridge, and it was pure virgin teak forest, it was like Epping Forest. You could see for 100 yards or more because high teak had little growth below about 20 or 30 feet. Only where it had been cut, of course, you got this secondary jungle where you got much more sort of briar and vines and things like that, which were made it much more difficult. That involved cutting. Now, cutting was really nasty at the beginning at the front of a column. And you'd only have guys doing it for about 5 to 10 minutes. Because not only did they have to cut, but they had to cut not higher than about 18 inches. And with a 70-pound pack on your back, bending down, trying. Because if you cut bamboo any higher than that, you left a sharp stake, which of course would rip the sides, the flanks of the mules and ponies. And maybe anybody else too. So it was a pretty nasty if you did get in. And you could do less than a mile a day in that sort of stuff. And so, you know, how far did one go in a day? It's not easy to answer.
When you were out on your own ahead of the column, did you go into lager overnight in the same sort of
way?
Well,
we got ourselves off the beaten track, let's put it that way. But of course, we didn't leave the trail behind us the way that. You could say to them, okay, right, now it looked fairly flat for 150 yards over that way. So we said, right, okay, left turn, everybody, and, you know, off you go for a bit. And then we'd pick up the trail and go on for another half a mile if we could, and then doss down for the night, and hopefully we wouldn't be followed in.
Did you have a drill for setting up a defensive perimeter overnight in the same way as the column did?
Well, yes, we tend to put the rifle sections into a sort of screen around and put our the